About now.
Give it a second. Try now.
Now? Is it working? 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, it's on.
Sort of working? Oh, there we go.
Volume's low.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and get started. This talk is the PostgreSQL Query Planner. I'm Robert Haas. This is a hopefully sufficiently shortened version of the talk that I gave at PostgreSQL East, where I had an hour and a half, so hopefully I took enough stuff out. Please feel free to interrupt with questions, but if I start to run short on time, I may have to postpone some of those questions until afterwards, since I'm backed right up against the next session. So I guess the first question that that you might think to ask in reference to the PostgreSQL query planner is, why does my query need a plan? In other words, why can't you just do it somehow, right? And the answer to that question is that SQL is a declarative language. An SQL query is not a program. It doesn't say anything about how to obtain the results that you ask for. If you say something like select star from foo where a equals 1, you're just telling the database that you want the rows where a equals 1. You want them. How the database gets them, you're not saying anything about that. You're not telling it to use an index, not use an index. However it comes up with them is fine with you, as long as you get the rows that you ask for. So another way to explain that is that SQL describes the results of the query, not the process for obtaining the results. And so that's what the query planner has to figure out. What process are we going to follow in order to obtain the results that the user asked for? One thing I generally caution people about is don't assume you're smarter than the query planner. Hopefully, over the course of this talk, it will become more clear that the things that the query planner does are very complicated, that there are a lot of things to take into account when figuring out what the best way to execute a query planner is. And so if you find yourself asking a question like, how do I force the query planner to use my index, you're really asking the wrong question. The question you should probably be asking is, why does the query planner think that using my index is going to make my query run more slowly? And is it wrong to think that it's going to make my query run more slowly? Because sometimes it is. Sometimes it will do that. So I thought before I got too deeply into the meat of things, it would make sense to talk a little bit about what the goals of the query planning process are. Generally, the first one that we think of is we'd like the query planner to make our queries run fast. How fast? Well, as fast as possible. How do we do that? Well, there's a couple of things we need to do. We need to minimize disk I.O. And in particular, we need to minimize random disk I.O. When you're reading data that's located in consecutive sectors on the disk, disks are slow, but they're not that slow when you're just reading around the disk like this. If the disk head has to jump back and forth to different sections of the disk to retrieve the data that your query needs, that's really, really slow. So we particularly need to make sure we avoid that kind of I.O., random I.O. Another thing we also obviously need to do is we'd like to minimize CPU processing. So generally, the I.O. component, if the data isn't fully cached, is going to be the dominant component, and the CPU contribution is going to be smaller. But if we have two query plans that use about the same amount of I.O., but one does less CPU processing, clearly we'd like to prefer that one. Or if we have one query that does less I.O., but vastly more CPU processing, it might not be a good idea. So the query planner has to take all these factors into account when it tries to figure out how to make our queries run fast. Another goal of the PostgreSQL query planner is don't use too much memory in the process of executing the query, right? If running the query causes Postgres to use so much memory that the machine we're running it on starts swapping, then performance is going to go to the dogs. So we need to try to make sure that doesn't happen. We can't really plan exactly how much memory we're going to use. We're not really quite that ambitious in the query planner, at least not today, but we have some valves and some heuristics that we use to try not to use too much. Finally, this is sort of obvious, but the query planning process needs to make sure that we're going to deliver the correct results. You know, query planning means looking at the query that we're executing and thinking about different ways that we could possibly obtain those results. And sometimes, as human beings, we look at a query and say, well, it could just do thus and so. And sometimes those transformations aren't things that the query planner can do by itself because they depend on knowledge that's outside the database. Like, we know we're never going to do this thing in our tables anywhere, so it would be safe to change this join into that kind of a join. But that's based on something that we know as based on business logic or as database developers, but isn't necessarily true based on what the database knows about the world. So there's going to be certain cases where the database might not be able to know that it can do exactly what we think it should do. So the query planner actually makes a lot of different kinds of decisions, and I don't have time to tell you about all of them in this talk. And actually, if I did have time to tell you about all of them, it might be a really boring talk because there's lots and lots of them, and some of them are fairly subtle and not that interesting. In this talk, I am going to talk about the two that I think are the big ones. The first question is, if we need to get some data out of a table, how can we go about doing that? What is going to be our access strategy for each table involved in the query? And secondly, if we need to combine data for two or more tables, from two or more tables, that is, if we need to join two or more tables, then what is our join strategy going to be? Joins always operate on two input tables and produce one result table. So if you've got a whole bunch of tables that you need to deal with, there's lots and lots of different possible join orders. You can pick which two you want to start first and which one you want to add in next and so forth and so on. You also have to decide for each join what's your join strategy going to be. We have three join strategies. I'll be talking more about them later in the talk. And finally, there's this inner versus outer decision. Each of the join algorithms has sort of two different roles that a table can be in, and we have to decide which table goes best in which role. And again, this will become more clear as I go through the details of how each of these join strategies actually works. Okay, so table access strategies. How are we going to get data out of a table? The easy one is to just do a sequential scan of the table. It's pretty simple. We just read every row in the table, right? Any possible thing that we could want to do to a table can be done this way. You can always read every row in the table, regardless of anything else. Now, if you have an index available, you might be able to use an index scan or a bitmap index scan. And in either case, the idea is that we want to read only part of the table by using the index to skip some of the uninteresting parts of the table where we know that the rows that we care about will not be. The index scan and the bitmap index scan, bitmap index scan doesn't mean some kind of thing called a bitmap index. It's a different way of using the same type of index. Okay, so the bitmap index scan refers to how we're using the index, not the type of index that we have. Okay, the difference is that an index scan reads the index and the table in alternation. So it reads a row from the index, a row from the table, a row from the index, a row from the table, row from the index, a row from the table, a row from the index, a row from the table. The bitmap index scan, on the other hand, is going to read all of the index rows. It's going to use those index rows to populate a TID bitmap, hence the name bitmap index scan. And then it's going to read those rows out of the table in physical order. So what are the advantages and disadvantages of each of these approaches? Well, as I said, the biggest advantage of a sequential scan is that it always works. You always have this option, right? The query planner doesn't get to not answer your query just because you don't have a suitable index defined. It always has to figure out some way of getting you the data that it asks for. And a sequential scan is always an option for getting whatever data it needs. A more significant advantage of a sequential scan that people often underestimate is that it doesn't require reading the index. It turns out that reading indexes is amazingly expensive. You know, early on in my use of PostgreSQL, I had some queries where the planner wasn't using an index, and I would create an index, and the planner was like, I don't want your index. It's not actually going to make this any faster. I'm like, I don't believe it. So I forced it to use the index, and guess what? The query slowed down. Reading indexes is expensive. Obviously, there are some cases where it's a big win, but not as many as you might think. Sequential scans are typically the best way to access very small tables for precisely this reason. In particular, if you have a table with 100 rows or less, and assuming they're not really big rows, I've generally found that the planner will very often choose a sequential scan and will very often be right. because it just doesn't make sense to look at an index page over here and a table page over here if you could just look at the table and forget about the index. And a sequential scan is also usually the best way to access all or nearly all of the rows in a table. Even if the index might rule out a row here and there, it may not really be worth it. It may cost you more to look at the index than you actually gain by how much you can skip. Index scans, obviously the big advantage of an index scan is that there's a potentially enormous performance gain when you're reading only a small fraction of the rows in a large table. So maybe the canonical example of this is you have a primary key on a column called, say, ID, and you select out the row where ID equals some particular value. Well, if the table is big, or even moderately big, it probably makes sense to use the index to do that. If you've got a million rows in the table, a few visits to index pages is going to allow you to skip lots and lots of table pages. This is the case we're all probably pretty familiar with if we've used indexes before in pretty much any database system. Another advantage of index scans is that they're the only table access method that can return rows in sorted order, which is really useful in combination with limit. Like if you want the rows in a table that have the 10 highest values from some column that you've indexed, an index scan is very likely the way to go if it's a substantial table, because neither a sequential scan nor a bitmap index scan can do that all that efficiently, and an index scan can. The big disadvantage of an index scan, aside from the fact that you have to look at the index at all, is that it tends to generate random I/O against the base table. So if you're dealing with big tables, big indices that aren't fully cached in RAM, you're going to be reading the index rows over here. You're reading them in sequential order. That's all very nice. But as you're doing that, you're reading table rows that are jumping around in the main part of the table because the ordering of the index and the ordering of the underlying data in the table are not necessarily correlated. So that can be very expensive in terms of performance in some situations. So bitmap index scan, as I say, here we scan all the index rows before we look at the base table and populate it to bitmap. And the result of that is that when we actually do the I/O on the base table, it's sequential with skips. The results are in physical order. We read all the index rows, we figure out all the places we're going to have to look at in the base table, and then we go through and we basically do what you might think of as being a sequential scan, except we just skip the parts that we know are not going to be interesting. Bitmap index scans are surprisingly effective. The performance benefit of switching from an index scan to a bitmap index scan for certain kinds of queries is pretty impressive. Another advantage of bitmap index scans that doesn't come up for me anyway a whole lot, but is pretty cool when it does, is TIDBitmaps can handle Boolean and OR operations. So with a regular index scan, there's really not any way to use two indices at once to answer the same query. A bitmap index scan gives you the ability to do that. So if you're looking for all the rows where A is 1 and B is 2, you can look at the index for A, figure out where all the tuples that might match that part of the query are. You can look at another index for B, figure out where all the tuples that might match that part of the query are, and then you generated two bitmaps in the process of doing that. Now you AND those bitmaps together before you go and you look at the main table. So now you only read the parts of the main table that passed the filters imposed by those two indexes. The big disadvantage of bitmap index scans is that they really are pretty terrible when it comes to limit. If you have an index condition that is going to match a large number of rows in the table, and you're only interested in actually returning a small number of those rows to the user, the bitmap index scan is going to do a lot of unnecessary work, where the plain old index scan is going to be a lot more efficient. Questions on that so far? Either it was all really clear or it was all really confusing. Okay, join planning. Fixing the join order and the join strategy is the hard part of query planning. The query planner spends most of its time, most of its memory, most of its CPU usage that it uses when planning a complex query on join planning. The number of possible ways to join a set of tables together grows exponentially with the number of tables, so it gets really big really fast. When the search space is relatively small, with some corner cases that certain people in the audience, Tom Lane, can probably think of, we pretty much consider all of the possibilities. But as the search space gets too large, the planner uses heuristics or something called Gecko, the genetic query optimizer, to limit planning time and memory usage. There are many cases where you can actually avoid the use of these heuristics or of the Gecko planner, even for fairly large queries, and things still work okay. But these safety valves turn out to be pretty important because it's not too difficult to construct a query where you use all of the memory on the machine and more time than you have to wait, and you're still trying to figure out how to plan the query, and it just never finishes. So there are safety valves in there to prevent that. If you know what you're doing, you can turn them off. Don't call me if it breaks. Join strategies. We have sort of 3.5 join strategies. Nested loop, merge join, and hash join. There's sort of a special case of nested loop, which is called a nested loop with inner index scan, which is where we're doing, well, I'll show you exactly what that is in a couple more slides. But there's some special case logic to handle that case. It's mostly the same as a nested loop, but not completely. Each of these algorithms operates by taking an outer relation and an inner relation and producing a result relation. So in fact, the way that these plans are eventually going to get executed, a lot of the work is pipelined, and we jump back and forth between different parts of the plan as we're executing it. But if you imagine, contrary to fact, that joins were done in order, every time you join two relations together, you now have one fewer relation to deal with. So if you have three relations, you're going to have to pick two of them to join together first, and then the result of that, you are going to join to the third relation. If you have four relations, you could join two together and another two together, and then those two results together. Or you could join two together, join the result of that to a third one, and then join the result of that to a fourth one. And you often have a lot of choice about what order to do those joins in. And Query Planner tries to work through all of these cases and figure out something that's going to be fast. So here's what a nested loop looks like. It's basically a nested loop. So you got two for loops, one inside each other, okay? For each outer tuple and for each inner tuple, if the join condition is met, then we emit the result row. So the fuzziness in here is, of course, that notion of each outer tuple and each inner tuple can encompass a lot of different possibilities. The outer tuples could be coming from a sequential scan, they could be coming from an index scan, they could be coming from a bitmap index scan, they could be coming from another join, they could be coming from a set returning function. There are lots of possibilities as to where those tuples could actually be coming from. Important thing to understand about nested loops is that the cost is roughly proportional to the product of the table sizes or the relation sizes. So it's bad if they're both big, but it's really, really good if one of them is really, really small. Like if there aren't any outer tuples at all, this is pretty fast. For each outer tuple, oh, we're done, right? It's also pretty good if there's no inner tuples a lot of the time, or if there's frequently only one inner tuple. Sometimes people say things like, well, we just shouldn't use nested loops if there's any way to avoid it because You know, it's really bad if there turn out to be more inner tuples than we expect, because sometimes our estimates are off. But there's a lot of queries where using a nested loop speeds things up, because nested loops have really, really low overhead, right? It may not be obvious just looking at this algorithm that this is low overhead, although it's sort of obvious because it's kind of hard to think about how you could do this any simpler. But certainly by comparison to the other algorithms, nested loops have a very, very low overhead. And so if you have a reasonable reason to suspect that there's going to be zero inner tuples a lot of the time, or one inner tuple every time, or a combination of ones and zeros, using a nested loop can really be the best way to go. Okay, so here's an example of what a nested loop plan looks like. You're going to be seeing this exciting query that I've put together here. Select star from foo, comma bar, where foo.x equals bar.x a few times as I go through these different examples. I had to be very persuasive to get the planner to choose this plan here, because it didn't want to do that at all, because it thought this plan was going to be bad. But this is a nested loop with a sequential scan on the inner side and a sequential scan on the outer side. So what we're basically going to do in this case is we're going to go through bar, and for each tuple in bar, we're going to consider each tuple in foo, and we're going to consider for every pair of tuples between foo and bar whether foo.x equals bar.x is true. If it is, then we're going to emit a result row. If it's not, then we're going to go on to the next combination. So obviously, this might be very slow if foo and bar are both large. One other thing to notice here is that there's a very distinct difference between what happens to the rows in bar and what happens to the rows in foo. Each row in bar gets visited once, right? Once and once only. Each row in foo gets visited once for every row in bar, right? So if this relation in here, assuming that that foo and bar were about the same size, we'd ideally like the query planner to make sure that this is not something that's expensive to rescan. That's what it's called when we have to look at the same tuples over again. It's called rescanning. You know, the query planner supports it and knows how to deal with it, but this is going to get rescanned a lot of times, potentially. This is not going to get rescanned. We're only making a single pass through here. So we have to think about not only what the cost of looking at those tuples is, but whether one side is going to be more expensive to look at over and over again than the other side. So here's a second example of a nested loop. This is the nested loop with inner index. Yes.
Just the slide before. What would make one's rescan to be more expensive than on the table than the other table?
Well, if they're both, so the question is, what would make one rescan more expensive than the other? If they're both tables, there's typically not going to be a huge amount of difference. Although, of course, the size of the tables will play into it somewhat. It might not be a table. For example, you might imagine that this is another join, right? It might not be so bad to have a join up here, but it would probably stink to have a join here where we're rescanning it over and over again. Yeah. Okay, so here back to my nested loop with inner index scan. This plan is probably a lot better. What the query planner has decided to do in this case is it's going to scan foo. And then for every tuple in foo, it's going to use this index bar p key, which is defined on the table bar. And it's going to check whether it can find a row where bar.x equals foo.x. If it finds one, then it will emit the result row. If it doesn't, then it'll move on to the next tuple in foo. So obviously, if bar is a big relation, this is probably going to be a lot quicker than the previous plan because we're taking advantage of this index. This is the good case for an index scan. We're going to just maybe read, you know, this looks like it's probably a primary key index. So we probably expect that there's only going to be one tuple popping out every time we do this index scan. So there's probably not a whole lot of need to do anything much more complicated here because this should be reasonably efficient because we're not going to have tons and tons of tuples coming out here on the inner side, which is the bad case for nested loops. So this is a lot better. It's probably still not the best plan. We'll get to that one in a couple more slides.
Robert?
Yeah.
Actually, the case where this really wins big is where foo is really small and bar is really big.
Yeah, so Thomas...
You only have to do the index scan a couple times in that case, and you're only pulling a very small amount of the bar data.
Right, so Thomas pointing out, I'll just repeat this so everybody can hear and the recording can hear, is a case where this really wins big is if foo is quite small and bar is quite large. You only read a small portion of bar, and you only have to do a few index scans on bar. You read all of foo, but that's okay because it's small. Okay, so merge join. This is a second join algorithm. One of the advantages of nested loops is that a nested loop can handle any arbitrary join operator that we have. So sometimes we might be doing something like where foo.x is less than bar.x. Most of the time, we're not. Most of the time, we're using equality. And both merge join and hash join, which I'm going to get to in a minute, only handle equality joins. So if you are joining two tables together with something other than the equal sign, there's a good chance that you're going to end up with a nested loop, like 100%, I think. So merge join only handles equality joins. The basic idea of a merge join is that we're going to put both of the input relations into sorted order, either using a sort or maybe using an index scan, and then we're going to scan through the two of them in parallel and match up the ones that are equal. So you can sort of imagine how this works. You've probably done this with some kind of real-world object at some point in your life. Right? Like if you're trying to match, if you've got a big box of books and another big box of books and you're trying to match them up and find out if you have any duplicates, you might think about putting the books in order by title or by author in each box and lining them up on two shelves and then going through them all and trying to match them up, right? This is the same idea. You just put the input relations in order and then you go zoop and make a single path, pass through both relations, and whichever one gets farther behind, you keep moving forward through that one until it passes the other one, and then you move that one forward and you go like this until you've made a single pass through both relations. So the effect of this is that basically, with an exception that I'm about to talk about, you only visit each tuple in each relation once, which is very different from what we were talking about a minute ago with a nested loop, where the inner tuples get visited over and over and over and over again. So the exception here is that if you have duplicates, then you may have to do a little bit of rescanning. If the outer side is something like 1, 2, 2, 3, and the inner side is 2, 2, 3, 4, by the rules of SQL, this one is going to match nothing. This two has to match both of these twos. This two has to match both of these twos. This three has to match this three, and nothing is going to match this four. So because each of these two twos here has to match both of these two twos here, there's still going to be a little bit of rescanning that has to happen here, but it's fairly minor. So merge joins don't have a huge amount of difference between the inner relation and the outer relation. As in the case of nested loop, it's the inner relation that gets rescanned, but it only gets rescanned to the extent that there are duplicates, so it's not a lot of rescanning, typically. If there is a lot of rescanning, then the planner typically decides this is a bad idea. Okay, so here's my merge join example. It's the same exciting query. Select star from foo and bar, where foo.x equals bar.x. And what the planner has decided to do here, again with some coaxing, is it's decided to sort foo on x, to also sort bar on x, and then we'll just make a pass through and match up the matching values. Yeah. What does the line materialize mean? So materialize means that after we finish this sort step, okay, and we've sorted the tuples, we're actually going to put we're actually going to go through and take the results of the sort and put it into a kind of a separate buffer materialize means, what's the best way to explain this? I'm not actually too sure why we're materializing in this particular plan, but in general, a materialize operation is when you take the tuples out of whatever context they were in and you put them, move them, you copy them into a temporary workspace. I think the problem here in this case may be that sort isn't guaranteed to be rescannable, and we might need to rescan the inner side. So just to make sure, we have to stick a materialize node in there for correctness to basically take that out.
We can actually make the sort cheaper if it doesn't have to promise to be able to rescan.
Right. So the sort can be cheaper if it doesn't have to be able to rescan. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, if you had a complex subquery down here, wouldn't this materialize be a big win? The answer is yes, and actually 9.0 is going to have some big improvements in the way that we think about materialization. It's hopefully going to be more accurate about where these materialized nodes get inserted. However, it should be said that there are cases where materializing amazingly simple things actually produces a performance benefit. Like I've seen materializing a sequential scan with no filter condition be faster than not doing it. And the reason, and you say to yourself, well, how can that possibly be the case? And the answer is that when we sequential scan the table, we have to determine for each tuple that we come to whether it's visible. If we're going to be doing that over and over again, it can be better to read through the table, find the tuples that are visible to us, copy them to a temporary workspace, and then when we go to rescan, we don't have to do anything. We already know these are the tuples that we're going to get. The visibility checks have already been done, and away you go.
Yeah, in fact, your very first example of the nest loop join had materialized on the inner for exactly that reason.
Yep. Okay, so hash join. Like a merge join, hash joins only handle equality joins. Here the idea is that we're going to take each row from the inner relation and hash it to create a hash table. And then we're going to hash each row from the outer relation and probe the hash table to see if we have any matches. My general comment about hash joins is that they're unbelievably fast. Like hash joins are really, really fast. A lot of times the planner will say, yeah, I know you've got an index, but I'm just going to hash join these guys. And it's really, really fast. The trouble is that you have to have enough memory to store all of the inner tuples in your hash table. The outer tuples you're probing into the hash table, so they don't always all have to be in memory at the same time. But the inner tuples are all going into the hash table. So here again we see the asymmetry between how the inner side is treated and how the outer side is treated. We have to have enough memory to store all the inner tuples. Now, it turns out we actually have a workaround that we can use when that's not possible, by using what are called multiple batches. And the idea here is that we build a hash table and we only put, say, about half of the inner tuples into the hash table, and we make a pass through the outer relation and do probes into the hash table. Then we go back and we take the other half of the tuples from the inner side, put them into a new hash table, throwing the old one away to save memory, and make another pass through the outer relation. And you might say to yourself, that sounds like it would be slow. And it is. It's slow, and it involves rescanning the outer relation. Nevertheless, I've seen cases where a hash join with 64 batches is faster than using an index on the inner relation. That's how fast hash joins are. They are really, really fast. You should usually be happy when you see a hash join in your query, because it's typically very speedy. At least that's my experience.
Do you get a phone in your pocket?
Yeah, I do have a phone in my pocket. Is that why I'm making noise?
Can I have a phone? Oh, you don't trust me? Fair enough.
So because of this multiple batch technique that is sometimes used, hash joins are not guaranteed to retain the input ordering, which is a disadvantage of hash joins that occasionally causes the query planner to use some ordering instead. Users sometimes want their results in a particular order, and higher level parts of the query tree, like merge joins, sometimes want their results in a particular order. And a hash join, at least potentially, destroys the ordering of the input if it spills into multiple batches. And so sometimes that is the thing that tips the planner over to using some other plan. It might say, hey, if I do a merge join, the results are going to all come out in the order that I want them to be in to return to the user, because the user has an order by clause. If I use a hash join, I'm going to have to generate the results and then sort them. Now, sometimes generating the results with a hash join and then sorting them is actually still the fastest way to execute the query. Other times it's not. It depends on a lot of things about the distribution of the data. Okay, so here's my hash join example. This is actually the first plan that I got when I tried to do this query, and it's probably the fastest one too. Select star from foo and bar, where foo.x equals bar.x. What the planner has decided to do here is it's going to hash bar, put the results into a hash table, then it's going to scan for foo. For each tuple in foo, it's going to probe into the hash table it built on bar. Any matches, it, for each match it finds, it will emit one result row. Yeah, Jeff.
Can you show an example where an S loop is much faster than, say, merge join or hash join?
So the question is, can I show an example where a nested loop is much faster than a merge join or a hash join? I don't have an example on my slides, but for example, suppose bar is an 8-gigabyte table. Right? Well, a hash join is going to have to, use a lot of batches in order to cope with that, like thousands of batches in order to cope with that. Unless, like Stephen Frost, you can actually set WorkMem to 8 gigabytes, in which case it might work okay. But most of us don't have that much, or at least I certainly don't have that much memory to use for one query. So really, where hash joins tend to go out is when the tables get too big, and you just end up having to use way too many batches.
But if you have like one, you know, really large table with, you know, an index on one small table, which seems to be kind of the case where it sounded like nested loop would work well, it seems like you could also pretty cheaply do a merge join, because that would quickly reach the end of the input on the small table. It would be able to sort it pretty quickly.
Yeah, the problem with that is if you're joining a large table to a small table, if you try to use a merge join, it may force you to sort the large table.
Well, if you have an index on it, then hopefully.
Okay, so this is actually an interesting point. If you have a really large table and you want to put it in a certain order, there's two ways to do that. One is to sequential scan the table and sort the thing. The other is to do an index scan, which already kind of knows what the sorted order is. And the index scan can actually be slower than sequential scanning the whole table and sorting it.
But wouldn't you have to do all those index lookups if you were doing a nested loop anyway?
Not if the other table is smaller. Just
no, not necessarily.
If you're joining
two tables, and let's suppose one of them is big, and let's start the other one off small and then gradually make it bigger too. If you're joining a large table to a small table, my experience anyway is that it'll typically start out with a hash join, where it hashes the small table and then goes through the big table and makes hash probes into the little table. That works great. Eventually, if you make the small table bigger, that starts to break down, because in order to avoid using too much memory, you have to start using more and more batches, which means rescanning the outer side more and more times, and it starts to get inefficient. So then, typically, if the inner side is indexed well, the next thing that happens is you switch to a nested loop with an inner index scan. If the tables get really big, then I think it usually ends up switching to a merge join eventually when it decides that the random I/O that's going to be generated from the index scans is too out of control, but it depends a lot on the situation. Yeah.
So when it's doing this equivalence example, it could choose either table for the inner, for the half.
Right. So we can choose, when the query planner plans this query, which is the same query I've been using throughout, it can pick a merge join, it can pick a hash join, or it can pick a nested loop. And it can pick which table it wants to have on the inner side and which table it wants to have on the outer side. And it can pick an index scan or a sequential scan or bitmap index scan. So just with two tables and two indexes, there's 20 plans or something that we can consider. And most real-world queries, at least the ones I write, are a lot more complicated than this. Okay, join reordering. So here are three queries. If you try it, at least if you try it with the sample data set that I used to create these slides and then threw away, but if you had tried it, you would have found that all of these queries, which look superficially different, actually generate the same plan. Because it turns out that they're equivalent to each other. They will always produce the same results. The planner knows that they will always produce the same results, and therefore it decides to execute them all the same way. Naively looking at this with the first query, you might think that what you want to do is join foo to bar first and then join the result to baz. Looking at the second query, you might think that you're going to join foo to baz and then join the result to bar. In the third query, you might think that you're going to join bar to baz, which looks pretty inefficient because that's going to create every pairing of a row from bar and a row from baz, and then join the result to foo. If you think about it, you can convince yourself that in the end, all of these queries are going to spit out the same results because they're all enforcing the same three condition, the same two conditions between those three tables at the end of the day. The query planner looks at the query that you type in, and it tries to think through all of the possible ways that it could execute that query, keeping in mind which other join orderings are equivalent to the one that you wrote syntactically. So the syntax that you enter doesn't have much of an impact on the query plan that you end up getting. There are cases where it does, but by and large, the query planner is going to say, you wrote this down, that's a suggestion, you're dumb, I'm smart, I'm going to figure out the right way to reorder these joins to make your query fast. And it's very important, right? Like, if the join between foo and bar is going to eliminate most of the rows, in other words, there aren't going to be very many pairs of a row from foo and a row from bar where foo.x equals bar.x, it's probably a good idea to do that one first and then join to baz afterward. But on the other hand, if there's lots and lots of rows that are going to match between foo and bar, but very few that are going to match between foo and baz, then we probably want to do the opposite. We probably want to do the join to baz first and then the join to bar afterward. This down here is probably a lousy idea in almost any situation because we're going to generate what's called a Cartesian product, every pairing of a row between these two tables, and then only after that start filtering down by joining to foo. That's probably not a good idea. And the query planner is probably not going to do that. One problem with join reordering is that not all joins can be reordered. If you stare at these two queries, which have the same kind of rearrangement as I was doing on the last page for long enough, you will convince yourself that if you insert the right data into these three tables, you can create a situation where these two queries return different answers. Okay? The difference, the thing that makes these examples different from the last ones is that here I have not only regular old joins or inner joins, but I've also got left joins. When you have a query that has left joins or full joins or right joins in it, it gets much more restricted in terms of how you can change the order of those and still get the same results. In most cases, most real-life queries permit quite a bit of reordering, but they don't permit totally arbitrary reordering. Okay, so I've managed to go this far without actually showing too much raw explain output, but I want to go ahead and do that a little bit. The plans that I was showing before were actually generated by explain with the new costs off option that's being added in 9.0, just to make them simple and enable me to put them in a large font so that you could actually read them from where you're sitting. Here, I did not put costs off, so I got the costs and the row estimates, which means that this example is harder to read. But you'll probably find yourself looking at explain output quite a bit if you're trying to figure out what's happening with your query. And it's not might not be entirely obvious what's going on here, so I'll try to give you the 10-cent tour. For each node in the plan, the planner is estimating two costs. The first number that you see before the two periods is the amount of work that the planner expects to do before that node of the query plan begins generating any results. In other words, that's the startup cost. The second number is the total cost. In other words, the amount of work that the query planner expects to do by the time it's completely done with that node. So this query overall is expected to use 404.52 cost units. They're not milliseconds. Okay, they're some kind of abstract cost units. Okay, accessing disk has a higher cost than doing CPU operations. There's a bunch of planner constants that you can fiddle with to try to get the right thing to happen. If it's not, I don't have time to go through what all of those are and how to fiddle with them in this talk, unfortunately, but those numbers get added up and you get some kind of a result. And here, this query, the best plan the query planner could find, takes 404.52 units of cost. You can see that this plan is going to start returning rows pretty quickly. It's only going to do about 2% of the total amount of work, 8 units out of 404, before it begins to be able to start to return rows. So if this query has a limit applied to it, this is a reasonably good plan because it's not too heavily front-loaded. The query planner will prefer plans like this that have a low startup cost, especially when you're only going to fetch a fraction of the rows. If you're going to return all of the rows, there's no limit or cursor involved, and all of the rows are going to get fetched, it will tilt toward looking at just the total cost. Each node in here has its own cost estimate. Each row in here also has an estimate of how many rows that node is going to produce. It's fairly difficult looking at this by itself to actually figure out where the wheels are coming off, which is why when you have a problematic query, you usually need to use explain analyze, which generates even more output in an even smaller font that you can't probably read at all. What you want to look for when you're looking at explain analyze output is you want to look for cases where the planner's estimates sucked. In particular, you want to look for cases where the number of rows that the planner estimated a certain node was going to produce is drastically different from what it actually produced. And that's where you're going to want to start to do your debugging. In this case, because this was a pretty simple query and I didn't do anything weird, all of the estimates are extremely accurate. And you'll often see this in a large query, even a large query with a performance problem in it, you'll often see that most of the rows are tremendously accurate. And then somewhere buried down deep, you'll find a place where there's a bad estimate, and that estimate will then propagate up to the parent node and the grandparent node and the great-grandparent node. So what you're looking for when you're looking at these plans is you're looking for the node that's farthest down that has a big error in the row estimation. What do I mean by big? Well, like if it's off by a factor of a million, that's probably going to cause a problem. And you know, you think I'm joking, but actually frequently it's off by huge amounts, and that's why you're causing a problem. An estimation that's a factor of three, you are very likely to not even notice. You're looking for things that are an order of magnitude and up. It's important to keep in mind that the planner can't possibly estimate everything accurately. But a lot of times, even when the estimates are inaccurate, the query plan actually still comes out okay. So what you're really concerned about is an accurate estimate isn't necessarily a problem by itself. We can't fix all the inaccurate estimates. What we care about are the inaccurate estimates that are actually making the query run slowly. And you can find those by scrutinizing this output and primarily look for places where the row estimates are different. You can also look throughout the plan and see whether the ratios between the costs, which are in abstract cost units, and the times, which are in milliseconds, where that ratio varies by a large amount. But I typically have not found that to be very useful in trying to figure out what's really going on. I typically start and end with the row counts. And once I find the place where the row count estimate is wrong, there usually is one. And when I find it, then I typically start to have a pretty good idea what's going on. OK, so join planning. We talked about fixing the join order. Planners got to decide what order to join the tables together in. We talked about the join strategy, which we've got to pick. And we talked about the inner side and the outer side and having to decide which relation is going to go on which side. So you might ask, how does the planner make these decisions? How does it figure out what the estimates are going to be? And what sort of things can mess them up? Well, all of the decisions that we've discussed in this talk are made using statistics. The decision as to whether to use a sequential scan or an index scan or a bitmap index scan, the question of whether to use a nested loop or a merge join or a hash join, those are based on statistics. We gather statistics about what the most common values in every column are. We also construct a histogram to kind of tell us what range the other values that are not the most common values in that column look like, what range they're in. The analyze command gathers this information and stores it in a system catalog. Analyze in modern versions of Postgres is typically handled fairly transparently by AutoVacuum. AutoVacuum will notice that you've made a bunch of updates to the table. It says to itself, that might have changed the distribution of data in the table. It fires off an analyze. And a few seconds later, the statistics are updated, and you're back on track. You can also issue an analyze command either on the whole database or an individual table manually. If you're not using AutoVacuum for some reason, then you should probably use AutoVacuum. But if you're not going to do that, then you should definitely make sure to run a manual analyze from time to time, because otherwise, as a table that used to be small gets big, or the composition of data in that table changes, you're going to start to get bad plans, because the planner is going to make its estimates as to how expensive things are going to be and how many rows they're going to generate it based on out-of-date information. One case where you frequently need to do a manual analyze is if you have a table that starts out empty and you dump a whole bunch of data into it, and then as soon as you finish, you immediately begin running a query against it that needs to be well optimized. In that case, you will sometimes find that AutoVacuum just didn't have enough time to actually fire off that analyze and get the results back and get them into a table. And if you don't do it by hand, then you get lousy plans. You must have good statistics or you will get bad plans. There's a couple of constructs that the planner, there's actually a lot of things that the planner doesn't understand. In some ways, it's amazing how good our planner is, given how little it really understands about the world at some level. But let me say, in view of that our planner is actually phenomenal. And the fact that our query planner is so good is actually one of the things that originally brought me to PostgreSQL. I was previously using another database which shall remain nameless, and beyond five or six tables, I just found that the plans were so terrible that my queries never completed. I have Postgres applications running with 34 table queries that are a little sluggish, and that's all right. I can live with that. But there are, if you really set your mind to it, or sometimes by accident, it's fairly easy to confuse the planner if you do something that it doesn't really understand very well. So look at this first query. Select star from foo where a equals 1 and b equals 1. The planner is going to need to estimate, especially if this is actually just a part of some more complicated query, what fraction of the rows are going to have both A equals 1 and B equals 1. The statistics that analyze gathers are going to tell it what fraction have A equals 1 and what fraction have B equals 1. But if 20% have A equals 1 and 10% have B equals 1, then the fraction that have both of those things being true could be anywhere from 0 all the way up to 10%. And the planner statistics are not sufficient to give it that information. And we haven't really thought of a way that we could make them sufficient to produce that information. So we have to guess. And the planner does something that's pretty reasonable, which is it says, if these columns are independently distributed, then it's going to come out to about 2%. 20% times 10% is 2%. And if those columns actually are independent of each other, that's a pretty good estimate. But sometimes they're not. Sometimes the distribution of the data in the table is such that there's very, very few or a whole lot more than we expect rows where A equals 1 and B equals 1 than what this formula estimates. Another way to confuse the planner is to just throw in some arbitrary expression. I have a good example here. The planner doesn't know anything about the behavior of the plus sign operator or of the number 0. It doesn't know that adding a number to 0 gives you back the same number. So you give it an expression like this, and it's just going to guess that 0.5% of the rows are going to match that criteria. Of course, we know that any rows where A is not null are actually going to match this criteria. Nulls actually won't match because null plus 0 is null, which is not equal to null because the SQL standard committee defined it that way. But all the rows where A is not null are going to match this. And if we put 2 in here instead of 0, we would get the same 0.5% estimate, which would now be wrong in the opposite direction. So I've occasionally had to rewrite queries to avoid these kinds of constructs because if the plan for the query relies on an estimation that's based on this, then you might get a bad plan. In one case, I actually stuck something like this into a query to fix an estimation error. I artificially tricked the planner into thinking there were 200 times fewer rows than it thought there were, and that was closer to reality, and actually fixed the plan this way. Okay, so what can go wrong here? Well, clearly, if the planner underestimates the row count, if it overestimates the row count, it can decide to do the wrong kind of plan. With underestimates, typically what happens is you get an index scan when you probably wanted a sequential scan, or you get a nested loop rather than a hash or a merge join, and things blow up. If the planner overestimates the row count, you get the opposite things. You choose a sequential scan when you would have been better off with an index scan, or you get a merge join or a hash join when you would have really liked to have a nested loop. These things are really painful when they happen, but it is important to keep in mind that it can go both ways. You know, maybe one or the other of these things happens to you more often than the other, and you think that the planner should be tilted in favor of the opposite one, but there are actually people out there who are experiencing the opposite set of problems. And you can find threads on performance where this has been discussed. And as I mentioned before, small values for limit tilt the planner toward plans that start up quickly. If we're not going to run the plan to completion, then we don't want to pay a huge startup cost to get going, even if it makes the overall plan cheaper. However, one of the effects of this is that if there are any bad estimates in the query plan, which hopefully there aren't, but sometimes it happens, if there are any bad estimates in the plan, having a small limit on there makes them much, much worse in some cases. Just a couple of things that are slow. You should try to avoid distinct. Tends to be slow. If you can redesign your schema so you don't need distinct, do that. PLPGSQL loops. People sometimes forget that they can actually make the query planner do a loop by just putting everything together in one query. Sometimes it's because the queries are complicated and they're having a hard time thinking about how to combine them. So they end up writing a loop where they're looping over a query, and for every row they get, they're doing another query based on that row. That tends to stink. You're much better off trying to figure out how to combine those two things into a single query. Calling functions is pretty expensive, especially SQL or especially PLPGSQL functions. People sometimes try to clean up their SQL queries by taking logic out of the query and moving it into functions. I highly recommend not doing that. In fact, do the opposite. Take the stuff out of your queries and out of your functions and put it back into your queries. It's going to run faster. It's okay to use views. Views get pretty much smashed, and the query planner can see into the view and know exactly what's going on. It'll still do a good job optimizing that. Once you wrap it up in a function, you've got trouble frequently.
SQL functions inline?
What's that?
SQL?
Yeah, sometimes SQL functions can be inline. Yes, Dan. Yeah, I'm finishing up. So there's, and it's, I'm not doing too bad. So upcoming features, I don't have really time to go through these. Join removal is my favorite one. There's a lot of improvements to the planner in 9.0. If they don't help your particular use cases, you won't care. If they do help your particular use cases, you'll be really, really happy. And it says questions, but Dan says I don't have time to take questions, so I'll be around afterward, and you can ask me stuff after.